Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Bush's fellow Republicans have been drawing up their own decidedly different plan. And separately, the U.S. Army releases its redraft of rules for interrogating detainees today. That reportedly includes a ban on procedures such as simulated drowning, known as waterboarding. Well, joining us on the line is Julian Barnes. He covers the Pentagon for the Los Angeles Times. And Julian, it seems to us that these plans intersect, you know, because interrogations produce the evidence used in military tribunals, correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is all about a comprehensive policy on how to question detainees, how to hold them, and also how to try them.
And how to use the evidence that might be used against them. And these stories are also linked, we understand, by articles in the Geneva Conventions. How so?
Well, at issue is what's called Common Article 3, and that has long provided sort of a baseline of treatment that all prisoners should be accorded. Now, back after the September 11th attacks and the war in Afghanistan, President Bush suspended Common Article 3 and said that it didn't apply to the war on terror. Then, back in June, the Supreme Court sort of overruled that and said that Common Article 3 did bind the United States, and the U.S. government had to follow that. And so that sent everybody scrambling. The Pentagon had been in the process of writing Common Article 3 out of their detainee policy, saying that it was not, that they would treat people humanely, but they did not have to follow Common Article 3. And what we have today is a new Pentagon policy that once again embraces Common Article 3.
Well, the details of the president's plan for trying detainees aren't out yet, but it's known what some of the main points of contention with the U.S. Senate are. We understand one of them, as we mentioned, is evidence. What are the others?
The evidence is the biggest one because the senators, the Republican senators, believe that the detainees should have access to the evidence against them. They should be able to hear what they're accused of and how strong that evidence is. The White House wants to be able to protect classified data and keep that from the detainees. The other point of contention that we know about is the appeals process. The Senate Republicans would use the existing military appeals court, while the White House would create an entirely new court to hear appeals.
And by the way, who are the Republican senators behind that plan, and what is their reasoning?
The main senators are Senator John Warner, the Republican chair of the Armed Services Committee, Senator John McCain, who was obviously the nation's most famous prisoner of war, and Lindsey Graham, who himself is a military lawyer. And Lindsey Graham has been leading a lot of this, saying that the Supreme Court says we should use the military justice system, and so that, therefore, whatever military commission plan we come up with should at least use that as a baseline.
Well, you report today that the new Army Field Manual that's also being proposed today will not maintain two standards for interrogations. What does that mean?
Well, after September 11th and after the war in Afghanistan, we essentially had one set of rules for what the administration was calling unlawful combatants, terrorists, insurgents, people who didn't wear uniforms, and then traditional prisoners of war, people who fight for a state, people who wear a uniform, like Iraqi members of the Republican Guard. This new document says that we're not going to have two sets of standards. There aren't two sort of rule books. There's just one baseline standard that applies to everybody, and everyone must be treated humanely.
What does that mean? What will it outline in the manual?
DOD's new policy that just came out says the inhumane treatment of detainees is prohibited and not justified by the stress of combat. And then in the field manual, we'll outline very specific techniques that have become controversial, like waterboarding or hooding prisoners or keeping people in long periods of solitary confinement, and say that that's not acceptable.
Congress forced a rewrite of the last draft of the field manual. Do you expect a fight over this one?
Well, this was supposed to be released back in May, and they started sharing their decisions with Senator McCain and others on the Hill, and Congress pushed back. So this is the document Congress wanted.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Julian, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and as we said, the president will unveil the broad outline of a plan for trying detainees in military courts in a speech later today. In a speech yesterday, President Bush quoted from previously unreleased al-Qaeda documents, expanding on the administration's recent comparisons between al-Qaeda and the fascist threat during World War II. The president said pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq would fulfill Osama bin Laden's wishes and propel him into a more powerful global threat in the mold of Hitler. History, the president said, teaches that underestimating the words of evil and ambitious men is a terrible mistake.
Bin Laden and his terrorist allies have made their intentions as clear as Lenin and Hitler before them. The question is, will we listen? Will we pay attention to what these evil men say?
We want to spend a few minutes today talking about these comparisons recently made between today's wars and World War II. In a moment, some history, but first, the politics. We're joined by Peter Canellos. He writes the National Perspective column for the Boston Globe. Welcome, as always, Peter.
Hi, Robin.
And we're also joined by David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post. Hi, David.
Hi.
And Peter, to you first. You've written about how this comparison is playing for President Bush on the stump. It's playing pretty well.
I think that it plays well because it communicates a sense of urgency. It communicates a clear enemy in a situation where there are a whole lot of nuances and a whole lot of variables out there. And I think that people respond to the very clear, direct storyline.
But as you also point out, it's also giving, you know, prospective voters a false image of U.S. troops. How so?
Well, I mean, there are many things about it that are debatable. I mean, starting with the whole idea that all of the terrorist groups that Bush mentions, which lately has included Hezbollah and Hamas and others, that all of them are lumped into this category of bin Laden and his terrorist allies. And I think most experts would say there's a very significant difference between the sort of Shia extremists of that we've seen in Lebanon, that we've seen in Iraq, and they're obviously one of the groups operating in Iraq, and al-Qaeda, which is, you know, a global group that really is dedicated to conducting large-scale attacks on the United States.
Well, as you write, this comparison between, let's say, you know, the fighters in Iraq and Nazis gives the impression that U.S. troops are locked in combat with armies of terrorists like Nazis.
Right. Well, Bush's argument is that that what we're doing in Iraq is somehow preventing Osama bin Laden from advancing. And in fact, what most troops are doing in Iraq is sort of serving as a kind of police and stabilization force where most of the violence is sectarian, that is between Sunnis and Shia, militia groups on both sides.
Yeah. And David Ignatius, also joining us, you just returned from Tehran in Iran. And you, prior to that, had taken a good long look at this comparison and asking, does it work? You say, well, yes and no. Tell us the yes first.
Well, the yes is that I think when you look back at the roots of fascism in Europe in the 1920s and 30s, you see unhappy, angry, almost sullen middle-class Europeans looking for someone to blame for their troubles. Especially in Germany, you see a nation defeated in war, seeking greatness again.
That was World War One.
Yes, mm-hmm. Defeated in World War One, attaching itself to this Nazi movement of Adolf Hitler. I do see some parallels to that in the Middle East, especially in Iran. Iran is a very proud, prickly country. Its whole history is seen through Iranian eyes as one of victimization, of manipulation by foreign powers. The same kind of rhetoric that one heard in Nazi Germany, you do hear from current Iranian leaders. It taps the anger of this rising middle class against the elites. The crazy thing about this in the Middle East now is that it is true that there are corrupt elites in these Arab countries and in Iran that have stolen from people, converted their hard work into villas on the Côte d'Azur, but they're not Israeli Jews. They're local people in the countries themselves. I think that's one of the saddest parts about this, that Israel ends up being the focus for an anger that, in some cases, has legitimate roots. People have been oppressed by their governments.
Well, as you write, it's one of the best definitions of fascism I've seen. We're going to speak to a historian in a moment, but you write, fascism gives ordinary people an explanation of what's gone wrong in their lives and someone to blame. And you see that parallel in the Middle East.
I do. I heard President Ahmadinejad ranting at a press conference I attended in Tehran. He seemed to rant almost most of all at a question I asked him. But, you know, this is a very charismatic, unpredictable man. This is a very, very dangerous adversary in the long run for the United States, I think in part because he has such deep populist roots in the country.
Well, but where does the comparison to fascism fall apart when it comes to someone like the leader of Iran?
My own answer would be that you know, we wouldn't speak of Franco or Mussolini or Hitler as Christian fascists, and the idea of talking about Islamic fascists, it seems to me, is a mistake in that it does tend to lump the Islamic world together. I mean, more to the point, any historical analogy that's argued this aggressively takes us back in time to, you know, another set of problems and individuals. I think we are stuck in 1939, sort of perpetually reliving Chamberlain's appeasement and those issues. I mean, the set of issues we face now are very dangerous, and President Bush is right to say that. But I don't think that trying to find parallels in the 30s makes sense anymore. We've got to see this for what it is. It's different. It's unique.
Well, Peter Canellos, that may be, but as we've said, you've been out on the campaign trail, and you've seen this kind of language working, and we've heard that it's been tested in focus groups, which is why it's being used. What is your sense, though, as we go into the midterm elections, of whether or not it's going to continue to work and continue to be used?
Well, I think it's especially effective at sort of rallying the base. And, you know, we are looking at midterm elections here when the Republicans are running behind in the polls in a number of elections. And I think that this kind of rallying around the flag, identifying a very clear enemy, identifying with loyalty to the president and to the president's plan, will probably work in the so-called red states where, you know, things like the Tennessee Senate race is in balance and Virginia and places like that. It might actually, there might be a backlash against it in some of the blue states where, you know, northern moderate Republicans are in tough races against Democrats, and the last thing they want is to have President Bush sort of hogging all the headlines and dominating the race when they're trying to differentiate themselves a little bit.
And people thinking about Hitler.
And people thinking about Hitler, yes.
Which, you know. Peter Canellos, columnist for the Boston Globe. We've also been speaking with David Ignatius of the Washington Post, just returned from Iran. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, just ahead, we're going to take another look at fascism and appeasement from the point of view of a history professor. And don't forget, later in the program today, if your child is headed for first grade, you might not recognize it. Homework, quizzes, even as early as kindergarten, kids are having to do essays and take tests. What happened to recess and nap time? We'll take a look at that. Much more coming up here and now. At Boston University to help us come in and help us understand what they mean to historians. Professor Lucas, what is fascism?
Well, I think I would say first and foremost that fascism, perhaps like communism, seeks to be taken for a legitimate political philosophy, simply yet another way of arranging political, economic, social behavior of human beings. But I think in reality, one must simply not be seduced into seeking definitions, and one must see that this is not a theory. This is a form of extreme behavior.
And yet in the 1920s and 1930s, there were people who absolutely were feeling that this, whatever it was, this theory, offered them something. What was it?
I think they were in love with the prospect of a better reality for themselves. And the better reality that fascism was supposed to promise was based on its extreme anti-liberalism that is wrapped in chauvinism and that uses militaristic methods for seeking solutions, especially on the international scene. Because one very important component of fascist thinking is that the walls are caving in, the roof is falling down, there is always a sense of an imminent doom, and the fascists are those who posture as those who have some kind of a solution.
When you say it's anti-liberalism, do you mean liberals or do you mean liberal thought?
Both. It is, of course, extremely anti-liberal because the basic fundamental unit of fascist thinking is not the individual with his rights. It is not even the citizen, but rather it is the state for the fascists or the nation for the Nazis.
And so how do you feel about the current use of the word, comparing Islamic fundamentalist terrorists to fascists?
It seems to me that all attempts at finding parallels between events in the late 20th and early 21st century on the one hand and events in Europe in the 1920s and 30s leading up to World War II are doomed to fail from the start.
Why?
Well, because I think, especially Adolf Hitler, was completely sui generis. He was completely unique in the context of human history, not in the sense that he was the sole embodiment of evil. We certainly know that individuals like Stalin or indeed Saddam Hussein had done many evil, horrible, horrible things. But I would argue that for all these individuals, violence or these evil deeds is supposed to be, in their own perverse way of thinking, an instrument for achieving an objective. If you attempt to find parallels and differences between, let's say, Hitler on the one hand and Joseph Stalin on the other, Stalin claimed, or he perhaps even believed, that what he was doing was to modernize Russia, was to industrialize the country. And if he needed to destroy 10 million or 15 million or 20 million innocent human beings, so be it. That's what historical progress required. If, on the other hand, you asked Adolf Hitler what he was going to do if or when his troops conquered Moscow, then what? Well, I'm not entirely sure he knew. Why? What was important for him was to be a warlord, was to stand amidst mayhem and destruction and the horror of war as a leader.
Let's turn to the word appeasement. And you ask just about any school child, and they'll say we're supposed to, it's something bad. But that wasn't always the case, and that's not always the interpretation of the word appeasement.
Exactly. I think that one must distinguish sharply between the meaning of the term appeasement that is derived from the notoriously failed policy by British and French diplomats who tried to prevent the outbreak of World War II by giving in to Hitler's demand. Now, there is no doubt whatever that this was a complete failure, that rather than preventing the war, it in fact encouraged Hitler, and it was indeed the policy of giving in to Hitler's demands that made him appear, ultimately even in the eyes of his opponents, as an omniscient, all-powerful man who perhaps knows what he's doing. So that kind of appeasement was completely wrong, utterly failed. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that appeasement as such is wrong always. One knows from personal relationships, one knows from a marriage, that being an appeaser is often the desirable position in which to be. The same, in my opinion, applies on the international scene.
Did the word appeasement also take on negative connotations when it was seen that some people were willing to cut Hitler some slack, if you will, when he was only killing Jews and gypsies and before he started his march, you know, across the globe?
I fear that this is exactly true.
But I just want to ask, before that, you've told us that appeasement had its roots in the devastating aftermath of World War I. I mean, when so many never wanted to see war again. Can you understand how the Bush administration worries now that the same thing is happening, that because of the experience of the Vietnam War, there are Americans who can't see Osama bin Laden for what he is, as at one time people couldn't see Hitler for who he was?
It seems to me that turning Osama bin Laden, a deranged criminal individual, into a phenomenon is somehow not the right policy, because it seems to me that engaging him militarily is probably exactly what he wants, because this is how he can recruit his followers.
Igor Lukes, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, helping us to put the words fascism and appeasement into historical perspective. Thank you, professor, very much. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL. And The Economist, the weekly global magazine, with commentary and analysis on world politics, business, finance, technology, and the arts.
Arching idea here. I mean, where is this all coming from?
You know, kindergarten used to be something like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. There was finger painting, there was playtime, and what's happened now is that kindergarten and first grade are actually becoming, you know, academic level periods for children in which there is testing, there's expectations that they need to meet certain requirements, and a lot more pressure coming from a number of places.
Where are those places? Where is this pressure coming from?
You know, it kind of depends on what community you live in. If you live in a working class neighborhood, your school is really probably been affected by the No Child Left Behind policy that was enacted by President Bush in 2002. And this is a policy in which schools are now held accountable for the academic performance of their students. So kids are expected to be reading at the latest by third grade, and principals are sort of rigorously testing children, making sure that they're learning a lot. I mean, kindergarten and first grade are becoming like literacy boot camp.
And tested and be able to read by third grade or what?
Well, or the principals and teachers might lose their jobs. There's sort of a very detailed set of measurements that they have to meet now, and they have to be accountable. And there's a number of kind of potential ramifications if the children do not do well. But educators are focusing on helping kids do well, which I think is a very good thing. But at the same time, in sort of more wealthier communities where kids are already given every advantage, you have parents who want their kids to someday go to Harvard, and the sort of pressures and expectations about performance are trickling down, and they're sending their kids to preschool for extra long periods of time, and they're expecting their kids to do more and sort of be smarter when they're in kindergarten.
So you're saying in some of the wealthier school districts, the pressure is coming maybe a little bit more from the parents, but I just want to be clear, in the poorer school districts, is there a different impact of No Child Left Behind because federal monies will also be cut if kids don't pass tests, whereas, you know, wealthier schools may not depend on that money as much?
I think the money is one issue, but, you know, the larger impact of No Child Left Behind, I think, is a good one in the sense that schools need to be accountable. And for too long, poor children were allowed to sort of not achieve at the same levels as middle class and upper class students. And so now they are helping kids achieve from the youngest age. And, you know, it's very important. Unless you learn to read, you don't have the building blocks to do anything else, math, any other subject. So it is important that kids learn how to read when they're young. But it's also sort of noting that we live in a society with a lot of different pressures, and now we've got these baby Einstein videos all these sort of videos aimed at children, young children, infants even, with the idea that if we somehow show them these things, they're going to be smarter sooner, and that's a good thing. And it's not been shown to be a good thing. What's important is creating a lifelong love of learning. And if we push kids too hard when they're in kindergarten, they could burn out by third grade.
Well, and you're seeing that. You write about parents saying that kids are literally burning out, that they're falling asleep at their desks, that they're crying in first grade, that they can't do their homework. What have been some of the impacts? What choices are parents making if they do feel that their kids are burning out?
You know, in the story, we profile one family who was living in California in a school district that was very high-performing and, for their child, high-pressured. They have a lovely little girl. She's very bright. She's eager to learn. But the demands were just too much for her. She had to write essays, and she would come home and just sort of put her head down and cry. And her parents decided that they were actually going to move rather than subject their daughter to first grade in this kind of environment.
They moved to a less stressful school district.
Exactly, and they felt like they were sort of swimming against the current because, while many of their friends were moving to situations where there were sort of schools they perceived as better and tougher and more rigorous for their children, they wanted to go somewhere where the environment, as they said, would be more flexible and allow their daughter to grow as she is ready.
You also write about something called, well, it's actually a term borrowed from sports, called redshirting. Tell us about that.
Well, redshirting is what many parents are doing now, which is rather than send their kids to kindergarten at 5 years old, they're holding them out and sending them when they're six with the idea that they'll have kind of a little edge over their classmates because they're a little older, a little more mature. And while maybe that's a good idea for one individual child, the net effect of that is that the kindergarten population is getting a little bit older and it's creating a lot more pressure for all the other kids.
Well, it's interesting you say that, you know, parents are holding kids back so that they'll be more mature and more competitive, you know, when they go back to school with kids maybe a year younger than them. But schools are also holding more kids back. In Buffalo, New York, more than 600 low-performing first graders were told, first graders went to summer school.
Yeah, you know, and that's, again, directly connected to No Child Left Behind. And many educators are thrilled that their schools are being held to high standards now. But what educators and people who study child development say is that young children learn at different paces. And while there are, of course, some children who come to kindergarten already reading, other kids don't really get it until they're in first grade, or maybe even a little after that, and that should be okay.
And we also should point out that there are schools that are fighting this trend, schools that long have. I'm thinking of the private Waldorf schools, but schools that really feel that there's actually something dangerous about pushing kids too early to learn.
You know, there is sort of a countervailing movement right now, too, to pay attention to the whole child. Child development experts say that play is such an important part of learning for kids, that even just time on the playground teaches them things like how to interact with other children, how to develop boundaries and sense of self, how to develop confidence, how to communicate. And so some schools now and some educators are focusing on what they say is the whole child approach. And, you know, kindergarten is a difficult time. It's hard to sit still in your seat and learn for long periods of time. And so kids who are sort of developed in a holistic kind of way are better positioned to be able to learn throughout their lifetime.
You write about a school in Chattanooga, Tennessee, parents lining up to try to get their kids into the Chattanooga School for Arts and Sciences because it takes that whole child approach.
Absolutely. You know, these are parents who are saying enough is enough. We don't want to be in an environment where our kids are being, you know, forced to take spelling quizzes when they're only in kindergarten. They're saying we want our kids to be in an environment where they're nurtured and they're allowed to learn at their own pace, that they're allowed to discover learning and how fun it can be.
Julie Shelfo of Newsweek magazine. Julie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And this note, classes in Detroit public schools are canceled until further notice today, the second day of the school year, because of a teacher strike. The teachers' union rejected a two-year contract proposal that sought wage reductions of 5.5% and co-payments for health care benefits of up to 20%. So now parents are scrambling to find care and worried that time out of school will affect their children's scores on some upcoming statewide tests. We'll continue to follow this story for you. You're listening to Here and Now. I have a confession to make. I like Coca-Cola. It's my Achilles heel. Well, actually, my Achilles heel is my Achilles heel after years of running. But anyway, you know what I'm saying. I like Coca-Cola, even though in grade school they demonstrated how it corrodes car engines. I like it. But even I took pause when I heard about the winner of the most creative concoction at this year's Texas State Fair. It's fried Coke. That's right. Two things you might be a little embarrassed to have separately, fried dough and Coca-Cola, combined in one tasty cholesterol-inducing treat. Fried Coke will be served up at the fair later this month, taking its place alongside previous winners, fried Twinkies and fried Snicker bars. Abel Gonzalez is the creator of Fried Coke. He joins us on the line. Abel, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Fried Coke? What's the recipe? Tell us.
Well, you can't just throw Coke in a fryer, you know. You have to add stuff around it. So we built a dough based on Coke. We actually pour Coke, straight Coke, just like out of a can, and add all kinds of other dry ingredients and make a sweet dough that we deep fry, and then we bring it out of the fryer and put it in a commemorative Coke cup and add a special Coke syrup, put whipped cream on top, and serve it with strawberry, cinnamon sugar, powdered sugar.
Oh, wait, so there is food in there. There's a strawberry.
Yeah, there is food.
How did you come up with this?
At the fair one year, somebody half-jokingly said, what are they going to start frying up next? The next thing you know, they'll be frying up Coke. And they meant it as a joke, and I just ran with it.
Last year, you won the top prize in the contest with fried peanut butter jelly and banana sandwiches.
Yeah, that one went off really, really well, and that was really good, too. We had a lot of success with that.
How many did you sell?
We sold 25,000.
Whoa.
Yeah,
So actually, you make some pocket change doing this.
A little bit.
And I'm curious because I know your day job, you're a computer analyst. So what is this, a hobby or?
My father was in the restaurant business, and I've always worked in the restaurants. And I'm a huge State Fair of Texas fan. I mean, ever since I can remember, I've gone every year, you know, and it's just a big deal. So marrying the two, the food and the State Fair, was not a big stretch.
Well, and what's a State Fair without a little fried food? And we understand that some of the finalists this year, in addition to your fried Coke, were, Fernie's fried mac and cheese. Fried mac and cheese. Or there's a donkey tail, which we understand is an entire, you know, all beef frank stuffed with cheddar cheese, wrapped in some sort of tortilla thing that's been fried. What's with the deep fry aspect of this?
People go to the state fairs around the country looking for, you know, that next deep fry thing, and they kind of look at it and go, well, I'm not going to try it. You try it, and, you know, I dare you to try it. And then they're very proud, and they tell all their friends that they tried a deep fried Oreo or a deep fried Coke or a deep fried Twinkie or whatever it may be. You know, it's our job as people that work the fair to actually make what they're trying good so that their first reaction isn't, yuck, you know, and the majority of the time it's not. If you tried the fried Oreos or the fried Twinkies or the fried peanut butter and jelly and banana sandwiches, you'll see it's not greasy at all like you would think it would be. It's very sweet, and they're very good. Most of them are very good.
Well, there's also the fried Chocorito, a flour tortilla stuffed with marshmallows, coconut candy bar pieces, caramel morsels, and cinnamon dipped in pancake batter and deep fried.
That was actually very good and very decadent. It was, like, very rich, and you needed, like, a big, huge glass of milk to go with it afterwards.
Well, and I would think a gurney. What's your...
Yeah. Well, the way we think about it, it's a one-time-of-the-year event. We like to think that people are really gorging themselves on all their fried food, and then it's just hitting the gym and salads for the rest of the year.
What's your cholesterol level?
I have no idea. I don't even want to check it.
I wouldn't if I were you. So here you have Abel Gonzalez, last year's winner with his fried peanut butter and jelly banana sandwiches. This year he wins the most creative award at the upcoming Texas State Fair with his fried Coke. What's next? I mean, what are you sitting around thinking might be next?
You know, there's a thing with us, especially at the State Fair, because of the huge hype that the contest has, and everybody keeps their next year thoughts to themselves, but you never know. Next year I might be frying coffee. Who knows? Right now I'm just trying to plug ahead for the State Fair, and then as soon as the State Fair ends, it'll be the next idea.
How about tofu?
You know, that would be a good idea. Lettuce, maybe? A salad? A fried salad? Do you think that's possible?
Abel Gonzalez, creator of Fried Coke, which won the Big Tech's Choice Award for Most Creative for the upcoming fair. Abel, good luck to you, and thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. ¶¶ They were a brilliant flash in the punk rock pan. Mission of Burma released just one full studio album and a few EPs before exiting the stage because of the lead singer's hearing problems. But those few recordings and blistering live shows influenced bands of today like REM and Nirvana and the musician Moby. Well, now Mission of Burma is doing something punk rock bands don't often do. They're reuniting after 19 years, and it's time.
I think it's a brilliant idea because the guys, I mean, they all have really good hair.
A new documentary, Not a Photograph, relives the Burma myth and follows the band from the slashed T-shirts to their new 9-to-5 jobs to their reunion tour and new CD, The Obliterati. And joining us now, Clint Conley, bassist and songwriter from Mission of Burma. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Aaron Lobel, producer of Not a Photograph. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And we want to start with you, Clint, because perhaps most interestingly, after Mission of Burma broke up, you became a producer for a very popular magazine television show here in Boston. It's called Chronicle. Is it possible that as the years went on, people around you, your coworkers, even your wife, had no idea that you'd ever been, you know, sort of a punk rock star?
Well, it's true that I stopped playing. People had the people I worked with sort of knew, yeah, that I was once a musician. My wife certainly knew that I was once a musician.
But she says in the film, never saw you pick up a guitar.
Yeah, I don't think she did. It's still puzzling to me because it was such an overwhelmingly just saturated my life. And, you know, at some point it just sort of curved off and disappeared.
Let's talk to people about the history a little bit. The band was Pete Prescott on drums, Martin Swope, who was the tape operator who did some of the live looping mm-hmm. that gave Mission of Burma such a distinctive sound, mm-hmm. guitarist Roger Miller. You know, can you recreate for us, as the film does, what it felt like to be on stages back then?
Well, it was very exciting. I mean, we were so excited. We were just bursting with energy. It was like we were there when the world was being created. This was, you know, a whole new music that had come along to sort of recorrect the path that rock had been on, which was growing ever more sort of pompous and corporate and bland. You know, punk rock came along with this, you know, supernova of excitement and creativity. We can remake the rules. It was our intent to make our music sound like no other music before. Of course, you know, that's ridiculous.
Well, no, but many would say you did.
Well, you know, even after we quit, we all felt great because we felt like, well, you know what? We did carve our little niche. We didn't sound like anybody else. And I don't think any of us were too bummed out.
No, it seemed a kind of calm acceptance of the fact that singer and guitarist Roger Miller had contracted tinnitus, mm-hmm. and his ears were bothering him. And so you all go off to these lives. You become, you know, a family man in the suburbs and a TV producer. Pete Prescott selling records. What did Roger do?
He's done a lot of soundtrack work. He's also done other bands. He's in a group called Alloy Orchestra, which does film accompaniment. And, you know, he travels the world doing that. So he's a very busy guy.
Right.
Of all of us, I retreated the farthest from the music scene. And, you know, life just filled up with other good things. I, you know, went to grad school and got married and started doing other interesting things.
Well, as you say in the film, you described yourself when the ideas floated of the band getting back together again. Here are your thoughts.
My big thrill is taking my kids to school, you know, dropping them off and going to their gymnastics class and stuff like that. So to pluck, you know, John Q. Milquetoast and put him on stage again, it's a little weird.
That's Clint Conley, a bassist and songwriter for Mission of Burma, on the prospects of the group getting back together. And as they did, along comes Aaron Lobel. He's the producer of the film about Mission of Burma and their getting back together. And Aaron, as you watch the film, you know, it's hard not to see, as it's hard not to see any film about a band now. It's hard not to see it through sort of a, what's the movie I'm thinking of?
Spinal Tap?
That's it.
You got it, babe.
Because did you think that as well?
Oh yeah, I felt like we were walking the line. It just felt like Spinal Tap.
I had to
here.
Promise the band that it would not feel like Spinal Tap in any way.
Yeah.
You know, I never thought it would be. You know, this was obviously an amazing story at the time. This band that had been so influential that no one had heard about, and our interns knew about them. You know, I figured I'd see 40-year-old people banging heads with 20-year-olds, and that was exciting.
And that is exactly what happens. Clint, were you aware of that, that you had influence? Well, with Moby, you must have been aware, because he covered one of your songs, That's When I Reach for My Revolver.
Father taught us boundaries, the knowledge we must go. I'm trying to protect my unity. That's when I reach for my revolver.
Were you aware of the wide reach of the music?
Not really. You know, I'd run into people and the younger people, and they'd say, oh, you know, like really, you know, love your band. And I'd see, you know, mentions from time to time in various press, you know, sort of using us as a reference point or something. I was delighted. I mean, I confess I was surprised at the level of response when we did play again and how excited people seemed to be getting. It was really overwhelming. It was very touching.
Here is Moby talking in the film about covering your song. And after that, a fan reacts to the fact that he did. Let's listen.
From my perspective, it's the most iconic of all the Mission to Burma songs. And this might sound melodramatic, but it's the truth. I was either going to get a Mission to Burma tattoo or put that song on one of my records. And so I put that song on one of my records. I still might get the tattoo. I don't know.
The songs have been used in films. When Moby did Clint's song, he was able to buy a septic tank with the royalties for his house.
Did you ever think, 20 years ago, that one benefit of writing the song When I Reach for My Revolver would be that you'd get a new septic tank?
Many would see perfect logic in that, I'm sure. It's just the weirdest collision of two worlds. You know, to be in the office one day working on something, you know, the thought will cross my brain pan that, well, tomorrow you're going to be singing in front of 1,000 people or something, and I'll almost feel like throwing up. It's just hard to fit it into my daily mindset.
Right.
But then, you know, when we get there and you plug the amp in and you turn the knob and you put the guitar strap on, all of a sudden you just start falling back into the rhythms of it, and somebody counts off and boom, you're off and running. And it's so deep. It's so enjoyable. It's really a joyful experience.
And Clint, though, before I let you go, I mean, how do your 15 and 10-year-old daughters and your wife feel about yourself? I mean, you've gone 19 years in a family without being this rock star. Now you're a punk rock star.
Yeah, very small, very low grade. Yeah. It's funny. I mean, my daughter is going out, my 15-year-old with a boy, and she said, oh, he plays guitar. I said, oh, did you tell him I play in a band? No! Oh, my God. No! She was so mortified. That's just like so, Dad, please don't say anything. It's just not an appropriate thing for a 50-year-old man to be doing. It's like seeing your father in a Speedo. It's like, oh, Dad, get back in the room. I don't want to see this.
Clint Connolly, thanks so much, and good luck with everything. And Aaron Lobel, again, the producer of Not a Photograph. Thank you both.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
Jesus.
I stood on the bridge, but I could not see. Stood on the bridge, but could not see. 1,001.
And for more information on the Mission of Burma CD, The Obliterati, and the documentary Not a Photograph, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. It's been 5 years. When disaster, man-made or natural, strikes, what do you do? Do your children know what to do? Also, is Star Trek really 40 years old? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now.